ebook publishers and marketing services company Just Imagine It, Inc. presents Get Behind Me, Now Stay There, a new fun-filled, informative podcast available on iTunes and right here locally on KSKQ Ashland, Oregon, 89.5 FM. Art and entertainment news and views. Today's podcast is brought to you by the fine folks at Downpour.com, the one stop for all your audio and digital book needs. Join the Downpour Audiobook Club and save up to 50% on digital downloads, exclusive member-only deals and promotions with no commitment, and you can cancel at any time. Only $12.99 per month. That's Downpour.com. On this episode, Mary Kay Henderson gives us a shout-out from the Cherokee Nation. Many people know Ellen Kushner as the host of NPR's Sound and Spirit. Chrissy McIntyre talks to her in New York. And The Death of a President, a powerful account of JFK's last 6 days, in our audiobook feature right after the news you want to know.
Charlie Stanton.
I'm Maya Seligman.
I'm Sarah Simerson.
I'm Chrissy McIntyre.
And I'm Jerry Renfro. Here's a look at our top stories in the art and entertainment world. Ender's Game, the futuristic story of children forced to fight an enemy race, battled to the top of the charts in the U.S. and Canada, defeating senior citizen buddy comedy Last Vegas and animated turkey tale Freebirds. I've been waiting 25 years for Ender's Game to be made into a movie, and it finally released.
You're that old?
I am that old. I'm older than that.
What'd you think?
I enjoyed it as a movie, and if it encourages people to go read the book, I am all for that. It was very enjoyable. Harrison Ford was great. The special effects were second to none. I mean, probably some of the best stuff I've seen in the last decade. It did really good. It knocked Jackass Presents Bad Grandpa, I think, down to second place, and Las Vegas came in third. So it was a good weekend for Hollywood. But unfortunately, Thor the Dark World opened, and so we'll see how Ender's Game does in its second week. Anybody else see it?
Yeah, it's against a big hitter.
Yeah, I mean, Thor
is supposed to be.
Thor brought in $108 million in 3 days, like 3 or 4 days.
Chrissy, have you seen Thor? Amazing.
I have not Thor. I don't usually go for those kind of movies, but I end up like forced to go if my husband's kind of like, can we please go to this? And I go, oh, all right, I'll do it.
You know what, it's crazy because the Thor movies, I'm not that, into it, but everybody seems to want to go see it. And I was really taken back with that because my daughter, who's 10 years old, says, can I go see Thor the Dark World? I've got to see Thor the Dark World. And I was like, wow, that's when kids at school are talking about it, it's pretty popular.
Yeah,
it looked great in the previews. You know, any movie where they show the hero protagonist like destroying this huge guy, and that's just like,
And Goliath.
Yeah.
Right, but that's just like, you know, early in a movie. I mean, that's not even like the epic battle. It's just like a scene. I mean,
the big rock guy.
Yeah, you know.
I think that's Korg.
Yeah, you know, it's just going to get better, bigger and better, like at the end of the movie, you know.
But does it mean, does bigger mean better? That's my real problem with those movies. It's
all in how you use it.
Yeah.
And it's like.
Well, the thing is, you got to remember Marvel's playing the long game.
I've been asking that question for years, man.
I know. How about just average? Yeah. You know, I mean, average is fine. You know.
Well, you know, it's interesting that you would bring that up because, you know, Marvel's really playing the long game. They have to make each movie, you know, encapsulated, you know, so that it stands alone on its own. But each movie is also setting up, you know, as Captain America, Thor, Iron Man all led to the Avengers, and now, you know, they're building up towards Avengers 2, so they have to make a movie but also lay the groundwork. And it's interesting too, because I was thinking about this with Ender's Game. You know, Ender's Game has, I think, 16 books now in that set in that universe. So there's a ton of source material. And that was one of the things that surprised me, was there was no effort made to set up any of the sequels. So it makes me think that it's going to be a one and done. So as long as it earns its money back, makes a nice little, it was $110 million budget. They made 25 the opening weekend, which was pretty much exactly what was expected. So I think it'll end up making a little bit of a profit, and it'll be one of those footnotes in history.
The most exciting thing probably about this whole Ender's Game project and everything is the book that Audible did with Orson Scott Card coming in and rewriting the book just for audio in time for the movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he released each one of them has interviews with him at the end, too. It's really fascinating. I read Ender's Game every year. I've read it over 20 times. I read every other book. That's my holiday tradition, as I reread the entire series. And I listened to those interviews, and it was quite fascinating to hear, you know, his thoughts on the subject. And I was really glad, too, to see that there was a huge boycott for the movie. So I was glad. I'm glad to see it do well.
Well, speaking of big movies and sequels, I know that there's another one coming up, right, Chrissy?
Yeah, absolutely. The Hunger Games 2, it's called Hunger Games Catching Fire, is coming out very soon. And, well, actually, it's out in London and it's in Brazil. And movie insiders have very high hopes for the release of this movie. The world premiere is held in London's Leicester Square. And the hope is that this movie will break all kinds of box office records. The first incarnation of the film ranks 6th in the all-time box office opening following The Dark Knight, the Batman films. But since this film has already broken records for pre-sale tickets, things are looking very good for this franchise. They're hoping to crush The Avengers, which holds the top spot, and...
Not going to happen.
No?
No.
All right. Well, I guess Jerry he's already zoomed in on it.
My precognitive powers have told me that will not happen.
Well, you know what? I think that, you know, the girls are on to something here. I think Catching Fire will surpass everything. And the reason I think that is that, we did a series. So I've read all the books when I got in touch with my inner little girl.
That's wonderful, Charlie.
It was. And it's... Catching Fire is far and away the best book out of the three. And Jennifer Lawrence is such a major movie star now.
She is so awesome.
Everyone's going to see that movie just to see Jennifer Lawrence.
Talented.
Yeah, and Josh Hutcherson is no slouch. He's a little cutie, that little kid. He's only 21. Oh, my God.
And
he's
I'm
legal,
the pervert.
Folks, okay?
I was going to say that. I didn't know there were any kids in that movie.
So, I mean, who knows? I mean, it's in Brazil. It opened into 1, 2, 3. In Brazil, it opened on 962 screens, and it's already earned $2.4 million. So, you know, it's just going to keep going up and up from there. As soon as it hits the audiences here, it's going to go bananas.
Well, you know, it might do well. I'll grant that. I think it might do good. But you know what the big difference between the Hunger Games and the Avengers is? I don't see anybody in Hunger Games Halloween costumes.
I disagree. I will see. I'm telling you right now, there is going to be so many little girls dressed up as Katniss Everdeen, the girl catching fire.
Yeah.
Including me and Cyrus.
Okay, we're gonna
Cyrus. Can we expect to see you as Katniss Everdeen next Halloween?
Yeah, you can, and I'm sure no one will get upset about it. Unlike with Ireland Baldwin, she got in a lot of trouble recently for her Halloween costume this year. She dressed up as a Native American from the Peter Pan movie. The Indian chief. I saw the picture and it didn't really look all that bad. I mean, it just looked like she had some war paint on and like some feathers or something. But it just caused this huge hailstorm of backlash. And her tweet that she put on her Twitter page, "Okay, everyone, I apologize if my Halloween costume offended you and your culture personally. However, I don't apologize to a majority of you who thought it was necessary to return the favor with a lot of hateful mentions," she wrote. "A Native American costume was an option at a Halloween store. I copied a Disney character, and I'm sorry that it offended you. She later went on to explain that she's a Cherokee Indian. So, yeah, it's amazing that all these people just attacked her on this. I don't know. What did you guys think?
I'm with you on that. I didn't think, you know, her outfit was, you know, outrageous or anything, and I don't really see what the big thing – it just seems like, you know, with Twitter and all these things is that, you know, people – Like I've said so many times before on this show, is that the great thing about the internet is it gives everybody a voice. The bad thing about the internet is it gives everybody a voice.
Yeah.
You know? So it's like, you know, a lot of those little, you know, comments from the Peanut Gallery you wouldn't hear normally, but nowadays you do.
Thanks.
But
to Twitter.
I didn't know that she was Cherokee Indian, and then because, you know, her father is obviously not a Cherokee Indian, Alec Baldwin, but, and I thought about her mother is from Oklahoma.
Mm-hmm. Wow. And we got the Cherokee National Youth Choir on this show, too. So.
Yeah.
Oh, that's right. And you know, I saw the picture, too. I didn't see anything offensive about it. My issue here is I think this is one of those situations where people are looking for something to be offended about. You know, and I think it really detracts when somebody really does something offensive. There was a couple of girls at a Halloween party that dressed up like the Twin Towers with little planes crashing into it and little fire. And I found that horribly offensive. And I think that when people react to stuff like this, it really detracts from things that really are offensive and that really do need to be talked about.
You know, I saw the costume too. And, you know, to put it in perspective, that wasn't in our country where that was done.
True. That was Great Britain, I believe.
And what do you think of the controversy about the baseball team in terms of the
The Washington Redskins.
I don't see the controversy. I mean, they have been the Redskins for like 80 years, and now all of a sudden it's an issue.
Did you see those hats that they created about the baseball caps that what would it look like if you had the New York Jews, right? And then they had this like classic Jewish character as like an icon for a baseball team. And when you saw that, like, and then the San Francisco Chinamen. And they had this like sort of like, you know, horrible caricature of a Chinese guy as the mascot for the team. And when you saw it next to the Cleveland Indians it was just like, yeah, no, that's really, it is. It's offensive.
But that's the difference between
thing. And, it's just a crude caricature.
I think that's one way to look at it. Another way would be that it's just a reflection of the times when that team name came 80 years ago.
Yeah, but we don't live in those times.
Yeah, and we don't say those words that we used to say. Right. I mean, the N-word was commonplace in the 1950s, and we don't say that anymore. That's like the difference is Redskin versus Indian. The Cleveland Indians versus the Washington Redskins. The difference is that Redskin is a racially derogatory term. And it always has been, and it always was. So that's where I think the difference lies. I don't have an issue with a team using Native Americans as a mascot, but using a derogatory term as the name of that team, I think, is where the issue is being drawn.
Yeah. Well, democracy only comes in numbers, you know. So, and that's the problem with Native Americans in our society is they don't have the numbers.
Underrepresented.
They don't have a voice.
Yeah.
So. You know, tough.
Well,
tough,
you know, President Obama weighed in on this, and he said that you know, he didn't have an issue with the Redskins name, but he could see where it might be misconstrued as that as being offensive. But because how some of the other sports teams, like the Atlanta Braves, who were the Milwaukee Braves, you know, he said they are characterized, or I don't even know if you want to get characterized, but they are portrayed as you know, the Braves, the Warriors, you know, or the Indians, just generic, the Indians, you know,
right.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, you know, you got white people, you got black people, you know, but you don't have like Native American people, because as soon as you say Native American people, it becomes tribal. You know, it's like, oh, well, I'm not, you know, I'm not just a Native, you know, I'm a Cherokee, or I'm an Iroquois, or I'm a.
And each one kind of looks out for its own.
Yeah.
Well, that's where I think, like I said, the line I think that is different here is the name. It's not the use of a Native American. It's the name involved. You know, that's because, like, I wouldn't have a problem with the New York Europeans, you know, or the New York Caucasians, you know. But, you know, if it was the New York Crackers, I might have an issue with it.
Well, at least Caucasians.
At least it's being brought into public consciousness to have dialogue about this. That's the interesting thing, is that as we evolve into different ways of looking at these important issues, it becomes part of the
discussion.
The discussion, yeah. But you know what?
It becomes part of the discussion.
It's one of those things where, you know, some people have an opinion on it, some people don't have an opinion on it. I honestly do not think they're going to change the name. The owner of the Redskins said he will not do it.
Yeah, Dan Snyder.
Yeah, and because, you know, his father owned the team, and he brought out all this. you know, things from the tribe that they named it, their team after, and everybody was cool with it back then. And as Jerry said, that was back then. But you know what? He's just saying, like, look, that's our tradition. It's like, okay, we're the Fighting Irish. Yeah, well, you know what, dude? We're not going to be the Fighting Irish anymore. Maybe that was Fighting Irish 100 years ago, but that was 100 years ago. Now we are just Notre Dame because it's politically correct.
Valid point.
Do you know what, though? They're missing out on a big opportunity because once they change the name, all those rabid football fans are going to go out and buy all the new T-shirts. Ooh,
you are
new
so
jerseys
cynical.
And the hats and the footballs and every other thing.
No, they are not, Chrissy. Have you seen the what? Have you seen Washington's team this year? They're going to the first thing they're going to have to do is they're going to take back $1 billion worth of Redskin merchandise,
or sell it on eBay.
Or sell it on eBay.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm a Giants fan. They're not doing much better. So.
Oh, the Giants. Yeah.
But if the Giants change their name, I would still, despite the season, I would still go out and buy the next whatever the shirt was.
Yeah, I mean, because everything's so politically correct of the Giants. What if they were the Midgets? Oh my God.
Well put. Well put.
Well, speaking of names that can catch attention, there is a group that's called Planet Booty.
Woo!
Yeah.
It's a great my attention.
Yeah, exactly. They're a six-piece kind of electro-funk group. They blend soul, R&B, electro-funk. And it's a really fun group that started in San Francisco. And their mission is to shake your tail feathers.
And not your Redskin tail feathers, by the way.
Oh, right. But
not those ones.
They have really infectious kind of funk hooks. And
let's hear a little bit of it right now. So we looking like a bee that's booty. You got me thinking like a freak that's booty. Guess what? That's hot. Booty. We ain't afraid to let it go. Can we put on a show? That's what. That's what.
The frontman, Dylan Jermick, he says, it's about stripping back the barriers of who you are and saying, I don't care who's looking at me. I'm going to shake it and get my cheeks sweaty. So really, their goal is to...
Didn't that give him a headache?
they want people to wake up and realize how beautiful their booties really are. And it's
do that every morning.
But they're very talented. It's a group that the two brothers are in it together. It's not just the fun of their names, but they're also talented. So Dylan is joined by his brother Nathan on the keyboards. And then they have also a range of instruments and digital stuff. Lady Imacita is a really fun, wild dancing female companion. So I'm really excited because they are doing a number of different shows. And one of them in December, the very beginning, Friday, December 6th, is in Ashland.
All right.
So I've heard of that place.
Yeah, it's a great town. Yep. Club 66, Friday, December 6th, Planet Booty is going to be playing.
Hey, we're going to have to go catch up. Yeah.
So I want to make sure I see all of you guys shaking your booties. I'll take pictures.
Right. And post them on
Never
Facebook without our permission.
OMG. So everybody's cheeks are nice and sweaty. It's going to be nice.
Well, I was just planning on, you know, coming out of my wrecking ball, but.
Come on a wrecking ball. Take it naturally. Just swing around and just wreck it all up.
Well, there is someone who said, not to get too caught up amongst the posterior puns, it should be noted that above all, Planet Booty packs a serious musical punch behind their antics.
Yeah, and you know, judging from that sound clip that we heard of them, it's going to be a lot of fun. They sound like a very good group, and I'm looking forward to seeing that. They're not the only people that poke fun, you know, at diversity.
Yeah, talk about courting controversy. Saturday Night Live, certainly no stranger to that. Recently, they had, you know, Kerry Washington from Scandal. She was in Django Unchained. She was the guest host, and she was doing a skit where she played Michelle Obama, and Jay Farrow was playing President Obama. And part of the purpose of the skit was to draw attention to the fact that currently Saturday Night Live does not have any female African-American cast members.
I don't think they ever have they?
They have. They've had four throughout the years, but not only one of them made it more than season, I believe. Ellen Claghorn was on for 4 years from 91 to 95, and the other three were one-season wonders, I believe. Maybe two, but I think it was just one. So they haven't, but they recently had Maya Rudolph, who's biracial, and she would play a lot of those roles. Well, Jay Farrow and Kenan Thompson, the two African-American cast members, have both come out recently saying they will no longer portray female characters.
Why?
So I don't know, and that's I'm thinking it's to draw attention to this particular issue. And, you know, Saturday Night Live is no stranger to having males portraying females. I mean, that goes back to the very beginning.
That's but, humor.
Yeah, that exactly. Part of comedy. It happened in, you know, Shakespeare time. The men played the women. Mm-hmm. So in this skit, she was Michelle Obama. And then the White House press secretary came in and said that Oprah Winfrey had come to visit. And she had to run off stage and turn into Oprah Winfrey. And then they said Beyonce had come. And she's like, let me guess. So, you know, it was all to point fun at, you know, and again, there hasn't been that many. She came back on as Winfrey, and then they made some jokes about the Beyonce thing. So Lorne Michaels, you know, has said that it is, you know, something he's aware of. There's been more controversy because Kenan Thompson came out and said that he felt that the reason was that the African-American actresses they had looked at just weren't ready for Saturday Night Live. So, of course, that's created a huge amount of hullabaloo.
Yeah, well, I did see the skit, and it was funny, and you know, before this skit even happened, when the season started, I was shocked to see six new cast members that are all white. I was very surprised they didn't have more African-Americans, especially with an African-American president. Because, you know, SNL does a lot of, you know, satire, political satire.
Yeah, but they already had the guy that did President Obama.
Jay Farrow,
And plus they had, what's that guy's
Kenan
name?
Kenan Thompson.
They already had Kenan Thompson, too. Right. So...
Yeah, so exactly. Well, one of the funny parts of the skit was he says we don't have Beyonce apparently, but we have six Matthew McConaughey's, and six of the cast members came in dressed like Matthew McConaughey. I mean, they could have easily done Ben Affleck or Brad Pitt. Yeah.
Well, Brad Pitt isn't doing Saturday Night Live. You know, he's doing very serious work now.
Like what?
He's an actor. he was in. He recently had a pivotal role in that new movie 12 Years a Slave, where he played a philosophical vagabond who objects to the oppressive living conditions forced upon the slaves around him, which is a nice role to play considering everybody else had to play these horrible people. And Angelina Jolie, his wife, is also sort of on the anti-slavery bent. Her directorial debut was the movie In the Land of Blood and Honey, which was about an unlikely romance that developed in a Bosnian war prison camp. And that also kind of held up the whole year up to the gruesome horrors of this kind of imprisonment. And now Jolie is working on a new movie based on the story Unbroken, which was by Laura Hillenbrand, I'm sorry. You know, she wrote the book Seabiscuit?
I didn't know that.
Yeah, which is great. And she wrote this book, Unbroken, about Louis Zamperini, uh-huh. who, I got to tell you, I read this book. And
what did you
when
think?
I got this news, when I was looking at this news article, I was like, oh my God, I read this book. It's an amazing book, what this guy went through. He was like, he's a down and out kid. He was in school. And then he kind of found running and started running. He became an athlete. He became an Olympic athlete, went to the Berlin Olympics in 1936. He didn't win, but then he signed up, he joined the Air Force, and his plane went down in the Pacific. He survived 47 days on a life raft with two other people.
Wow. That's amazing by itself.
Yeah, that's a story by itself. That's amazing by itself,
but it goes from bad to worse because then he's caught by the Japanese and went to this insane prison camp. I mean, it's shocking what this guy went through. And then to come out of it, then he, you know, they won. And obviously, spoiler alert, we won the war. But and he came home and, you know, this is a sort of the story that keeps audiences coming back because it's the story of this people are held against their will. They either they're freed or they escape and they go on to live full and productive lives. And it's so heartwarming and enjoy. Well, obviously, people love it. And that's what she's – so Angelina Jolie is taking on this challenge of this film.
You know what? I hope she's really good with it because I saw In the Land of Milk and Honey, and it was a fantastic movie, very well, you know, acted. She's not in the movie.
No.
She's a director, and she also wrote it. And
I think Brad is in it, though, right? He has, like, a little part, doesn't he?
No, he's not in – no, he's not in it.
Brad Pitt was in World War Z. I don't know if any of you guys saw that.
I did not see it. I think he produced that too. He bought the rights. His company bought the rights to it, and then he produced it and starred in it.
You know, the movie, it's okay. There's a part where it kind of loses its credibility for me, where they put him out on a bicycle, like through this dark alley with all these zombies around.
That happened to Maya the other day.
Out in Halloween.
She's out on Halloween on her bicycle.
They have zombies.
But World War Z, it's almost like an autobiography for Brad Pitt. I mean, he's like a UN guy. You know, it's like Brad Pitt's real life with zombies.
Because everybody's life is made cooler with zombies.
But I'm going to tell you something really interesting about Brad Pitt, okay? Now, I have met him a few times. When we lived in Southern California, he lived in Southern California, and he was not famous at the time, but he was always around, right? Because he was – now, check this out. This is a true story. He was – there was a new chain of restaurants that just came out called El Pollo Loco, which is Spanish for the crazy chicken. Right. He was the mascot, man. He was the guy standing on the corner.
Kidding.
Yeah.
Chicken outfit?
In a chicken outfit, you know, going, hey, El Pollo Loco, man, that chicken's crazy. Right? That's what he used to do while he was looking for gigs in Newport Beach. Kind I don't know abilities. What came first, man, the chicken or Brad Pitt.
Well, he is, you know, as an actor, he's quite talented. Some could even say he's a genius, an acting genius.
Well, I'll tell you who is a genius.
Yeah, Kanye West is a genius.
Of course, Kanye West.
Self-proclaimed, yeah. Well, he just kicked off his first solo tour in 5 years, just this last month in Seattle. However, he has postponed 5 concert dates since then, with more most likely to come. The reason is because of a car crash. Brad Pitt was dressed as a chicken. No.
And Kanye West was chasing behind rooster.
It was a big publicity stunt. Kim Kardashian was there too. It was their wedding.
And Northwest, their baby.
Yeah. Right. Yes. That's right. And Jerry, they spelled that North, N-O-G-T-H.
Yeah, but in all seriousness, there was an accident. And according to a statement by Def Jam, the truck carrying the Yeezus Tour's custom-made video truss and 60-foot circular LED screen was in an accident that damaged the gear beyond repair. As a result of this event, it is impossible to put on a show, and the Yeezus Tour will be postponed until these essential pieces can be re-engineered and refabricated. So Kanye West is off the hook. We're not sure how long it's going to take, but he's definitely proven that he is a rock star.
Canceling shows. He is the new Axl Rose. But, you know, Maya, what could we do in the meantime?
I think we should do some downward facing dog.
Oh, okay. Well, let's do it. Damn, my cheeks are sweating.
Well, for those of you who don't know, of course, it's a yoga position, right?
Oh, of course, everybody knows that, of course.
Well, yeah, everybody does because yoga is so popular these days. And that's, of course, a position in yoga. But actually, few people understand the history or, you know, the mysterious origins of yoga. Right now, there's a show called Yoga, The Art of Transformation. It's at Smithsonian's Sackler Gallery for the next few months. It spans 2,000 years, and it's the first exhibition to study yoga as a visual metaphor, from its spiritual roots to its current status as, you know, the global exercise technique. So it includes so much stuff: photography, film, painting, these sculptures, books, films. Even there's like a 1938 film of T. Krishnamacharya, who's the grandfather of modern yoga. So it's pretty interesting. It's going to be... I think well attended, especially because there are actually yoga classes being offered during at part of the whole collaboration. You know.
You know what? Do you do yoga?
Every once in a while, I remember doing it when I was like 6 years old. Like I grew up in Ashland. You know?
Of course, I've been doing it my whole life. So you did it in school?
Not in school.
That was a joke. Kindergarten, Ashland. Yoga is required.
Yeah.
Chrissy, what about you? Have you done yoga?
I have done yoga. I was part of that wave when it was like, oh, everybody's doing yoga. We have to do yoga. Oh, let's go. Oh, I'll see you at yoga. All right, bye. See you next week at yoga.
My question is, you know, is it sounds so cool, and the people that I see touting it, like, you know, Alec Baldwin, Paul McCartney, mm-hmm. and stuff like that, these guys that all, you know, then they ask them, you know, how'd you lose this incredible weight, or how'd you get in such good shape, you know, and they were like, I started doing yoga.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Well,
oh, yes.
Yeah, like, I have a friend, and he works, does a lot of labor in his job, and he had major tight muscles and all these problems. He had never done yoga before, so he started doing yoga, and he says he feels so much better. And he's the kind of guy I wouldn't expect to be doing yoga, but he totally likes it.
So. What about you, Jerry? You ever done yoga?
I have. I've done yoga. Actually, I did it quite a bit in my late 20s into early 30s.
Does it work? I mean, what's the deal behind it? I'm not asking this, you know, as like a, you know, for entertainment value. I'm asking because I've heard so much about it all these years. I mean, what is the magic about it?
Well, there's two aspects of yoga. There's the physical aspect. You know, it's essentially an isometric type of exercise. So instead of it's not like cardio, you know, you're not running in place or anything like that. You're stretching it out and you're holding these poses, you know, it stretches out the muscles. That's why it's used for a lot of people like to loosen up like your friend
with
the joints.
Well, it's not really stretching them a lot. I mean, you're building them when you're holding these poses.
Well, and that's how muscle is built, is by micro tearing and then rebuilding. So, and that's what it does. You're stretching it out, it tears and it rebuilds and you gain more muscle. And then there's the other aspect of yoga, you know, which is the spiritual aspect of it. You know, I meditate. I've done it for years. I'm a little too big to do yoga right now, but that's I'm working on getting back down. My wife currently does yoga a couple times a week, and it's the great thing about it is it's whole body exercise, not just the whole body, but you know, one of the principles of yoga is mind, body, spirit. You know, so it's your body, it's your mind, it's your spirit, all kind of brought together. And in fact, that's why it's somewhat controversial too. You know, you were talking about doing yoga in school, and I think here in Ashland they offer it.
You know, that's a good point. And real quickly, you know, because when I first started being aware of yoga and everybody, you know, it was all trendy and stuff like that. I mean, one of the reasons that, you know, I never really got involved with it was because I was just like, do I have to like join a cult or something?
No, I know. And there's like all of the poses have different names. And the one I always remember is Shavasana, because that's when you lay down and you relax at the end of at the end of the workout. But there are all these different names. I can't remember the language that it's in. So it can seem like slightly intimidating, and
most of it's in Sanskrit.
And of course, the thing about yoga too is that you are not going to be able to do all the poses right away. Right. You're just not. You know, you can't get yourself into these pretzels immediately. It takes time. It takes practice. So.
Oh, that is so funny because you just reminded me.
But the thing is about yoga is that every time I do it, I always go, "Oh, that felt great. Why don't I do this more often?" And I kind of forget.
What I really like is it puts me totally in the present moment. Like, because I have to be so concentrating and breathing and present in how my body feels, I really like how it also just energetically and emotionally can be a really grounding practice.
I'll have to give it a go. And it's amazing, you know. For some odd reason, when Chrissy was saying you can't do all the positions, I flashed on that movie, Forgetting Sarah Marshall.
Yeah, yeah. If you want, you can just lay in child's pose. Yeah. No shame in it. Child's pose is fine. Yeah.
Yeah.
Kristen Wiig.
Yeah. But you know, when Kristen Wiig is there and Russell Brand, who's like doing all these amazing things. And,
right.
And the other guy's like,
look at me, I'm doing a headstand.
Yeah,
my brother's a yoga instructor. It's one of the things he does in his spare time. So.
Wow. I'll have to give it a go.
Okay. Yeah, that's right. I do know what time it is. It's time to get the answers, everyone. And when I need to know, I go to Jerry Renfro. He knows. So listen up. Higher education is coming our way. Now I love it. And God bless America.
Where do you go when you need to know? Go to Jerry Renfro. He knows. Where do you go when you need to know? Go to Jerry Renfro. He knows.
That's right. I am Jerry Renfro, and I'm in the know. And after this, you will be too. Today, we're going to talk about dogs. I love dogs.
Yay!
They're loyal companions and beloved family members. Anybody here have a dog?
Yeah.
I have
a dog. It's a 50-pound ball of love.
Oh, that's so adorable. I have a dog as well, and it's an 80-pound English bulldog.
Nice.
And he's absolutely one of my bestest friends, and I love him.
Yeah.
So there are different categories of dogs. If you've ever watched the AKC show, you know there's hunting dogs. These are like Labradors, Golden Retrievers, and Dachshunds actually are a hunting dog. They were bred to hunt badgers.
Hot dogs.
Hot dog. Yeah, the packages of hot dogs. Nowadays, I have a friend who's got a little one who looks like that's all she eats. So the working dogs are like the Tibetan Mastiff. Then there's guard dogs, Mastiffs, Rottweilers, and Bulldogs are all guard dogs. Pastoral dogs, which are like collies and sheepdogs. Those are the ones that like work in the field helping the herders, exactly. Sled dogs, like the Huskies and the Malamutes. And then companion dogs, like the Shih Tzu and the Pomeranian. There's also a couple of interesting facts. The pug, everybody, you've seen a pug before?
Yes.
Everybody thinks China, which is where the pug originated.
Wait, are those the ones with the smushed faces?
Yeah, the little
faces?
Squished in face. That's called brachiocephalic, meaning that their nose, they have a small nose. As you know, the pug is of Chinese origin. It was a companion dog to the emperors of China for a long time. But it actually was brought into Europe in the 1600s by the Dutch East India Company and became wildly popular. It was the official dog of the House of Orange. It was the subject of a number of Renaissance-era paintings. It was huge in Europe. They loved it. The dachshund, like I said, was bred to fight to hunt for badgers or anything that lives in like small holes. It's got those little tiny legs. And then the bulldogs, most people don't know this, but they were actually bred to fight bulls. That's why they're called bulldogs. A pack of them would take on a bull, but they were considered to be too aggressive and they were actually outlawed.
Now, did they fight them in the pit?
Yeah, like in an arena. They would fight them in an arena. And so they were outlawed.
Is that why they're called pit bulls? No, seriously.
No, pit bull is different. Actually, pit bull is a misnomer. There really is no dog called a pit bull. It's a catch-all term used for a number of different breeds, like the Staffordshire Bull Terrier, and dogs of that variety are called pit bulls. But there is no actual pit bull. One of the things that separates those types of dogs is most dogs, the jaw muscles go up to just below where they're about where their ear would be, the bottom of their ear, which gives them a certain amount of chomping power, and the pit bulls, that it goes all the way up. And now you know.
And that's your art and entertainment news. Keep listening for Downpour's special feature.
Music helps me learn my language. Music allows me to share my culture. Inspires me to be myself.
Music connects me with the rest of the world.
Tika no gida.
Mary Kay Henderson serves as the director of the Cherokee National Youth Choir. She talked about the music and their upcoming appearance in the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade with the president of Just Imagine It, Inc., Charlie Stanton.
Love that guy.
Welcome, everybody, to another exciting interview here on Get Behind Me, Not Stay There. Today, we're really privileged to have on Mary Kay Henderson. She is the director of the Cherokee National Youth Choir. Welcome so much, Mary Kay.
Hi.
So let's start off with, the first basic question is, you guys are in Oklahoma.
Yes, we are.
And you have this beautiful National Youth Choir. And tell us a little bit about it, how it got started. And I know you guys are going to be in the Macy's Day Parade for this Thanksgiving.
Yes, we are. The choir actually began in the year 2000. Chief Chad Smith, at the time, he was our principal chief, saw it as an opportunity to encourage our young people to learn more of the language because, you know, learning through music is so much easier a lot of times than learning just by reading or writing or, you know, in other ways. And so there was a teacher in a Cherokee community of Kenwood who was already working with children and teaching them Cherokee songs or songs in the Cherokee language. And so she and her name was Jan Ballou, and another woman was Jamie Geneva from the Stillwell community. And they joined forces and began the Cherokee National Children's Choir. And they were children mostly from that Kenwood community at that time and just or selected children from the area that Ms. Ballou knew about or Ms. Geneva knew about. So it started kind of in that way. And then in 2003, both women, because of differences with their jobs and this was kind of a thing on the side for them, they decided to step down. And Kathy Sierra, who was a parent of one of the children at the time and also worked in the chief's office, she kind of saw them through the obligations that they had to the end of the year. And they put out a call for a director, and I answered that call and was hired in 2003. And so we've been with the choir together, Kathy and myself, for 10 years. And,
wow. Now, all the children that sing in the choir, what's the age ranges?
Well, we have changed. In 2003, one of the things that we, when we reevaluated the choir and looked at it, traveling with children like first, second, and third grade is overwhelming for the kids.
I bet,
the parents. Yeah. Well, and they would take the parents along, and it was just like, you know, you can imagine.
I can. I have small children myself, and it's like, hey, the circus is in town.
Yeah. So one of the things that we changed at that point is we became the Cherokee National Youth Choir, and it became an audition group, a group that in January we auditioned the kids. Any Cherokee student, 6th grade through 11th grade, can audition to be in the choir. And then they re-audition every year to make sure it's something they still want to be a part of, because it's a huge commitment on their time. They have to come in to Tahlequah and rehearse once a week. And then plus we get a lot of requests for engagements.
I'm sure you get a lot of requests because the music is just beautiful. You have a new album out called For the Future by the Cherokee National Youth Choir. And for our listening audience out there, let's hear some of the choir. And this song is called North Wind. North Wind, such a cool song. I don't speak Cherokee, and you know, to be quite honest with you, I really don't know anybody that does. But is it a difficult language to learn?
It really is, because there are so many nuances, and like even here in the United States, we have things that are said a certain way in the South, and then in the North, they're said, you know, a little differently. The same thing within the Cherokee Nation, even in our 14 counties, we have words that are said a certain way in the southern part and then a different way in the northern part, which may be, you know, 150 miles in distance, which doesn't seem like much, and yet it's worlds apart. Different little communities would say different words in different ways.
Right.
But usually they can understand one another.
Okay, yeah, I follow you. It's like the English language, for example. They speak English in England, but even though the words are the same in America, they have different meanings.
Right.
And different pronunciations.
Absolutely.
So you guys are going to the Macy's Day Parade. How exciting is that? Have you been there before, or is this the first time, or what?
This is our second time. We were first invited in 2007. And talk about coming out of the blue, there was a Cherokee man in New York who said, you know, I'd really like to see the Cherokees. I'd really like to see some Cherokee kids in this parade. And he happened to talk to somebody who knew somebody. And I've heard this story, but I've never met the individuals in this line of how it came to be. But they called us, and then last year, Wesley Watley, who puts together this parade, he and several other people there at Macy's, they gave us a call and said, we need the Cherokee National Youth Choir back. So we're very excited to be going back again.
Well, for the children, now, are they going to be you know, accompanied with their parents this time around, or is this like a field trip for them? How do you guys work that?
Well, back in 2003, when we started doing more youth rather than children, we, you know, just take chaperones that go along with us, you know, per room. So we don't take every child's parents. You know, that's just, it's just too cost prohibitive and finding rooms and things like that. And so we're taking 27 young people and 10 chaperones, I believe, counting Kathy and myself. So we will fly out on Tuesday from Tulsa and then be in New York Tuesday night for our rehearsal, which will be outside and in front of Macy's. And then Wednesday we'll do a whole sightseeing day. They'll be exhausted Wednesday night. Then we get up Thursday morning and do the parade itself again, and then have Thanksgiving dinner all together that afternoon, early evening, and then a little more final shopping Friday morning before we hit to the plains at noon. So it's a really quick trip, and yet there'll be a lot crammed into that.
Oh, yeah, it sounds like a whirlwind trip, and boy, what a lifetime of memories for those children.
Oh, it will be great. And what's exciting about this is I'm sitting here looking at one of the pictures of us on the float last time. None of the students that were in the choir in 2007, the last one that went to Macy's graduated last year. So this is a whole new crew of kids that we're taking on this trip. So that's very exciting. And I'm looking at these pictures of the kids that are on the float and realizing that they're now in college or graduated or with college degrees and are some are teaching, some are right. Coaching, some are doing all these other things. And they still talk about going to the Macy's parade. So,
well, it's we really look forward to that. And I know everyone watches the parade, and my children watch it. And it's just a great thing that you guys are doing out there. And I'm really kind of fascinated about this Cherokee language. Is it spoken widely in your area, or is it just something that you guys have to teach? In other words, the children when they come there, do they already know how to speak Cherokee, or do you have to teach them?
Most of them have to be taught everything. In fact, I'm a second language learner. Kathy, Cherokee was her first language. And so everything that I know to this point, I have learned through, learning the songs, learning different things. The Cherokee elders, like my mother, she had been discouraged from passing her language on. Even her mother was discouraged to pass that language on to my mom. My mom was the baby of the family. And so my grandmother had seen my mother's older siblings be punished in the schools for speaking her language. And so she'd resolved that the baby, my mother, who's now 83, would not speak the Cherokee language. And so they, in 1991, according to the Fishman scale of language loss, indicated that the Cherokee language was 1 to 2 generations from total extinction. And so that's what prompted Principal Chief Chad Smith to start some different language programs within the Cherokee Nation. We were just one of those. We were the youth choir, and then there was also a Cherokee immersion school. In our youth choir now, we finally have students from the immersion school. We have 3 students from the immersion school who have now joined the youth choir, who have auditioned and made the youth choir, I should say. So all of the programs are now starting to work together. Does that make sense? It takes for all that to, to gel.
It makes sense, and it's amazing, that how languages, not just the Cherokee language, but a lot of languages around the world, how they just they just fade out. I mean, mm-hmm. I guess, for example, for our listeners out there, I mean, one of the dying languages that's huge is French. People just don't speak it anymore unless they're in France or in Canada, in the French provinces. And even then, the French, they speak the Creole in the South here in America, and the French they speak in the Quebec, they're different versions.
Absolutely.
It's not the true French like you would hear in France, and it's just amazing that how some languages just kind of die out and over time. And I think it's great that you guys are doing this. There's probably so much that it could be gained from knowing your native language.
Well, and this year we decided to incorporate into our program for the year, there are still, they call them all Cherokee singings that go on in the 14 counties here of the Cherokee Nation of northeastern Oklahoma. And they sing all gospel, old, like 1800s gospel songs that were translated into Cherokee years and years ago before even the Trail of Tears. And they still sing those same songs. And they sing them without accompaniment, and somebody will just stand up and start a song, and the rest of the group will join in. Until recently, if you did not read Cherokee syllabary, you could, or didn't, hadn't learned it growing up, you couldn't participate in these. But we have taken these old hymns, old whatever, and have written them down and written out music for them and guitar chords and different things, so that as students learn to read music, then they can read those songs, but they're not written necessarily in syllabary. They're written in the phonetics, so that you can read along with the books, the CDs that we have for sale. We have books for all of those. And so that's one of the things that we're trying to do to make this easier for other people to learn that language, and for grandmother to pass it down to daughter and daughter to son.
Well, I think that's beautiful. And I, you know, wish you guys all the success in the world with that. And all of our listeners out there, I encourage you to watch the Macy's Day Parade this Thanksgiving, 2013, where the Cherokee National Youth Choir will be on a float and performing. And go out and pick up copies of their CDs. You can get them on CD Baby. You can get them on the Cherokee gift shop and the website. And of course, all the links will be provided for you on Just Imagine It, Inc. Mary Kay, it's been so great talking with you. Will you come back on and talk to us about it after you guys?
I would love to.
You know what? We really look forward to that.
To learn more about the Cherokee National Youth Choir, visit us on our website at justimagineitinc.com.
Kushner's magical career has found a home in audiobooks. She shared her insight with Chrissy McIntyre in this interview.
Welcome to Get Behind Me, Now Stay There. I'm Chrissy McIntyre, and I recently spoke with Ellen Kushner. Ellen Kushner is the acclaimed author of many works of literary fantasy. She's also an award-winning audiobook narrator and producer, and as if that wasn't enough, Ellen is also a teacher and lecturer. So that's where we started. I first asked Ellen about her writing process and how she begins.
Okay. I'm like the worst example. I'm the person you don't want to imitate because I have dreadful work habits.
Oh, no.
But, the more I probe my other writing colleagues, including the very successful ones, everybody says if it weren't for deadlines, I wouldn't get anything done. Because there really is a point in your life. It's very hard because you remember how when you were a kid, writing was what you did for pleasure and escape.
Right.
And when you're an adult, usually your life is a lot more fun and a lot more under your control. And, of course, now that we have, Facebook and just hanging out with your friends online at any hour of the day or night, it's even less appealing to sit by yourself in a room struggling with prose.
Mm.
There's so many alternatives. When you were a kid, there weren't as many alternatives for fun. So
well,
I think a lot of us feel like, wait, what happened? Writing used to be fun, and now it feels like work, and I keep doing other things. Whereas, when you're a kid, like all you wanted to do was be by yourself in your room and write. And you kind of have to deal with that and go, okay, who am I now, and what are the reasons for me to sit and do work when I could be doing something else?
Also, when you're a kid, you don't have an editor telling you, like, hey, by the way, this is terrible. Like, you need to rewrite
this. Oh, no, no, no. You don't have that as an adult either. And I think a lot of people, that editor is in your head.
Oh, okay.
Most people translate that editor into their head and have this extremely hostile person living in their brain who hates their work. And you don't need that person in your brain. That person is not useful. I tell my students, I teach writing at this MFA program at Hollins University in the summer. It's a wonderful program. And I say, look, there's a point where you need to be the editor, but that point is much later in your process. I can talk a lot about process. I think a lot about process. That point is much later in your process, and right now you just need to spill a lot of stuff on the page and don't let your editor in. Say to your editor, thank you very much, I know you're very smart, and I know you want the best for me, but you need to go in another room and knit for a bit, or go watch TV, or go play. And then when I need you, I will call you. And then you ask your editor to come back in and help you when you're in your final, final draft and you're trying to polish at that level.
Final, final. Okay.
Mm-hmm. There are many drafts, and anybody who thinks there aren't is just kidding themselves. And a lot of people stop writing because their first draft isn't perfect. No professional I know it doesn't know better than that. You know, we all know it's going to go through multiple drafts.
Right.
You just take that as a given.
Our conversation moved on, and I wanted to find out how Ellen got started with audiobooks.
I wrote my three novels, which are all interconnected. They're kind of a series, the Riverside books. Mm-hmm. They're all set in the same place, and they have a lot of the same people in them, but they're at different periods in their lives. Okay. In this city that I invented, in this world that I invented. It was published as fantasy, but there's really no magic in them. So they were considered radical new fantasies. And they were published before audiobooks were really a big thing. Mm-hmm. And because I have a lot of radio background as well, I had done a radio drama, which was produced by Sue Zizza of Sue Media Productions here in New York. And she looked at me and my work and said, gee, you know, you have these three books that have never been put into audiobook, and you are a professional, you know, voice talent. Why don't we record you reading your books? And I have to tell you that I have always wanted to do this. And I give readings a lot at science fiction conventions and whatever, and, you know, I do readings here in New York. And people are always going, oh my God, are you going to record that? You have to record your books. I'm like, you know, I would love to do that, but it would take a producer coming to me with a microphone and saying, hi, here's a studio, here's when you're coming in, and you're going to read for me before I will do it. And that is exactly what happened with Sue. So anyway, we did these audiobooks, and we decided to do something really different with them because Sue is, at heart, a radio drama person, and she wanted to bring some of the qualities of radio drama into these books. So in addition to the fact that the author has read the books out loud to you, you also get Sue's panoply of sound effects, and we commissioned original music for the series by a fabulous young film composer, which got more and more detailed and complex as we went through these books over the year and a half that we produced them.
Of course.
Maybe it was 2 years. And also, just for kicks and kitty thrills, we threw in some actors reading some of the scenes. Like, some of the scenes get brought to life. We call it illuminated audiobooks. Where, you know, some of it's just me reading and maybe an occasional sound effect or some music. And then suddenly, I always say it's as if you fall asleep and hear, and the thing comes to life. And suddenly you hear this very textured soundscape and actors reading the lines of the dialogue lines while I'm still reading the narration. The audiobooks have won awards, and the fans talk about them a lot, and we get all sorts of really entertaining reviews on Audible.com.
No, I think that's fantastic. So you also wrote radio dramas as well?
Yeah, well, I was the host of a National Public Radio series for many years called Sound and Spirit, and that was just me talking about stuff and playing music and doing these highly scripted, highly, highly produced shows. But I also did some indie stuff on my own, some of which was drama. And the most recent project that I did for that, along those lines, was called The Witches of Lublin. And again, if you go to my website and click on anything, we just reorganized the website. It should be pretty clear. So Witches of Lublin, I wrote with two other artists, clever musicians who are also filmmakers. So we had this very dense, wonderful script, and we produced it, you know, and we worked on it very hard. And then we had to find a producer, and we were lucky enough to hit up with Sue. And I believe it debuted April 2011 on National Public Radio and other stations around the country, and then was rebroadcast a year later and is still available and is also available as a CD and as an audiobook.
Neat.
You know, it's a whole thing. So that's a couple of years old, but that was what I did, and that's how I met Sue. And I wasn't involved in that except as a writer.
Okay.
And, you know, sort of sat on the sidelines, giving opinions when I had them while we recorded.
Why do you think there's such a big uptick in the desire for audio dramas and audiobooks when, I mean, you know, you think with all the video and all the CGI and everything is so, we can make things so visually beautiful. and people are really seeking out sort of an old medium.
Because you can't watch video while you're driving.
It's as simple as that.
It is as simple as that. Because when I live in New York City, so I don't own a car.
Right.
And I was really curious to, and I don't listen to audiobooks. When am I going to listen to audiobooks? So I went online, I have a blog, and I said, I just want to take an unscientific study. Who listens and when do you listen? And it turns out that for most people, it's a commuting issue.
Mm-hmm.
People now have half-hour, 45-minute driving commutes to work.
Right.
And a lot of them listen to audiobooks then. The other majority is people who exercise and want something to listen to because, again, you know, you can't really hold a book in your hands while you're running
You're bouncing on
the treadmill. So a lot of people do that. I mean, and there are, you know, people tell me other things. They listen to audiobooks when they're falling asleep. They listen to audiobooks when they're cleaning the house. They listen to audiobooks when they're knitting. There's a whole crew of knitters who listen to audiobooks. But anything where you can't use your eyes, but you still want to be entertained.
Right. Okay.
So it makes a lot of sense to me.
Yeah, it does. One of Ellen's latest projects is the audiobook Welcome to Bordertown. And it's more than just a book, actually. It's an anthology of short stories and poetry. It was co-edited by Holly Black, and they added a little something extra to this book.
I really wanted to do something special with it. I wanted there to be music in it because a lot of the setting takes place in like clubs and there's musicians, and I just wanted there to be something special. And I knew a lot of musicians who could do great work, including one who actually, his original band, Boiled in Lead, was kind of the inspiration for some of the bands that we put into Bordertown.
Okay.
And so I asked him to write music. And I also knew that all the old Bordertown fans were like big fans of his.
Okay.
A guy named Drew Miller in Minneapolis. So we did everything from some of the authors in the book didn't write whole short stories. They wrote as poems, and a lot of those poems are lyrics for songs.
Oh.
So I said, well, let's set them to music. So we ended up just writing underlying track music for most of the poems, but we did one that was fully produced by Drew with the author, Stephen Bruce, who's a really popular fantasy writer, singing his own lead because he's also a musician. So it's got Bruce singing his own song fully produced band track with Drew's band, Thelonious Bosch. So we've got that. And I asked Brilliance if I could read not only my own introduction, but also the poems, because I just thought it would be fun. You know, if I'm in the studio already, why don't I put my voice down a little bit more in this book?
Sure.
When we got to Neil Gaiman's poem, I said, you know, nobody can read this but Neil. He just has this unbelievable voice. So this whole project, as you can imagine, was kind of elaborate and finally came together. And so Brilliance is in this really weird position where they issued the original book back about a year ago, the original audiobook, I should say. And the book was done by Random House originally. Then they had to bring out the new special edition, which they brought out September 1st. So mm-hmm. It's very, very new. And there was a kind of question of how are we going to, A, or how are we going to let people know this exists at all? And B, how are we going to let them know this is different from the other one? So fortunately, there was a hardcover and a paperback of the book, and they had different covers. So we did the same thing. You know, the old version that's what I call the vanilla version is the original cover, the hardcover cover, and then the deluxe edition is the paperback cover.
Right. So, Ellen, thank you so much. This has been fabulous. Thank you so much for being a part of our show.
I really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Thank you.
To learn more about Ellen Kushner, visit us on our website at justimagineitinc.com.
The Death of a President.
The number one New York Times bestselling author of American Caesar and The Last Lion offers a compelling account of one of American history's most dramatic and tragic events, the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. This vivid, powerful account of JFK's last 6 days, the only record authorized by the Kennedy family, is written with remarkable detail and immediacy, and an intimacy that is unparalleled. Though it is now 50 years in the past, the effects of that terrible day in 1963 are still felt today.
On February 5, 1964, Mrs. John F. Kennedy suggested that I write an account of the tragic and historic events in Texas and Washington 10 weeks earlier. That is the first breath. The second, which must quickly follow, is that neither Mrs. Kennedy nor anyone else is in any way answerable for my subsequent research or this narrative based upon it. My relationships with all the principal figures were entirely professional. I received no financial assistance from the Kennedy family. I was on no government payroll. No one tried to lead me. And I believe every reader, including those who were closest to the late president, will find much here that is new, and some perhaps that is disturbing. That is my responsibility. Mrs. Kennedy asked me but one question. Before our first taping session, she said, "Are you just going to put down all the facts, who ate what for breakfast and all that, or are you going to put yourself in the book too?" I replied that I didn't see how I could very well keep myself out of it. "Good," she said, emphatically. And so I am here, weighing evidence and forming judgments. At times you may find my presence exasperating. You may decide in the end that I have been a poor judge. But you may not conclude that I have served as anyone's amanuensis. If you doubt me, you may as well stop at the end of this paragraph. Actually, I discovered the Kennedy family had not been eager to have any book written about the president's death. Understandably, they needed time to heal. But shortly after the burial in Arlington, various writers solicited their cooperation in such a project. It soon became apparent that volumes would appear in spite of their wishes. Under these circumstances, Jacqueline Kennedy resolved that there should be one complete, accurate account. I had not been among those who had approached her. I had been living in the Ruhr and was writing German history. At that time, I had not even met her. However, her husband had told her about me, and she had read a magazine profile I published about him the year before his death. Robert Kennedy also remembered my acquaintance with his brother. After consultation, other members of the family agreed with Mrs. Kennedy that, in light of the fact that apocryphal versions of those days were already in press, it would be wise to have a book written by an author whom the president had known. It was further decided that the work should be based upon material gathered while memories were still fresh. Hence the invitation to me.
An articulately organized and utterly compelling compilation. The New York Times. William Manchester was an award-winning American author, biographer, and historian, and a professor emeritus of history at Wesleyan University. Among his many New York Times best-selling books are Goodbye Darkness and The Last Lion, a multi-volume biography of Winston Churchill. For more information about top-selling titles from this award-winning company, go to downpour.com.
I wanna be rich and I want lots of money. I don't care about clever, I don't care about funny. I want loads of clothes and fuck loads of diamonds. I heard people die while they're trying to find them. And I'll take my clothes off and it will be shameless, 'cause everyone knows that's how you get famous. I'll look at the sun and I'll look in the mirror. I'm on the right track, yeah, I'm on to a winner.
Now Stay There is a Just Imagine an Inc. presentation and was recorded in the Blackstone Audio Inc. studios in Ashland, Oregon. If you would like more information about this show, or if you or someone you know would like to be featured, please call us at 541-708-0525 or visit justimagineitinc.com. I'm Maya Seligman.
I'm Sarah Simerson.
I'm Jerry Renfro.
I'm Chrissy McIntyre.
And I'm Charlie Stanton, and we like you, so be sure to like us on Facebook. And remember to get behind me.
Now stay there.
Life's about film stars and less about mothers. It's all about fast cars and cussing each other. But it doesn't matter, cause I'm packing plastic. And that's what makes my life so fucking fantastic. And I am